Akatra Foundation presents the Akatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Today, we are taking on a real giant, you know, a man who's always operated at, well, maximum volume, both on the stage, the stadium stage, and in the halls of global power.
That's right.
We're diving deep into the soul-searching memoir, Surrender. 40 songs, one story, came out in 2022, written by Paul David Hewson, who, of course, the world knows as Bono.
Yeah.
And the book, it's structured around 40 U2 songs. It kind of uses the music as a map, really, to navigate this extraordinary life, a life full of contradictions, too.
And for you, the listener, this is it's much more than just a backstage pass.
Really?
Bono uses this book, this opportunity, to sort of dismantle the huge rock star icon he built.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, he reveals this profound insecurity, actually, and grief, stuff that defined his early years back in Dublin.
So our mission today really is to unpack that central tension, you know, the constant struggle between this massive ego and this relentless drive to surf.
Yeah, and between faith and doubt, too. It's all in there.
Exactly. And figure out how, you know, at the end of the day, he found his strength in what seems like a simple act, surrender.
Simple, but not easy.
Definitely not. So let's unpack this chronological journey, because those first, say, 15 years of Paul Hewson's life, they really set the stage for everything that came next.
They really did.
He was born on the north side of Dublin, working class area, 10 Cedarwood Road, back in 1960. He talks about a pretty quiet, stable home life, actually.
Which almost makes the trauma, when it hit, even more shattering.
Exactly. The sudden death of his mother, Iris.
Mm. He was just 14.
Mm.
And the circumstances were just horrific.
Yeah.
She collapsed from a cerebral aneurysm at her own father's funeral.
God, that's awful.
Yeah. She died a few days later. And he writes about it, calls it the primal scream that kind of echoes through everything. Every lyric, every campaign, every stadium show, it's always there.
And what's really key here, I think, is understanding the emotional fallout at home. He describes it becoming a three-man household. Just him, his older brother Norman, and his dad Bob.
Right. And grief just wasn't dealt with. It wasn't talked about. It was this stoic, uncommunicative silence.
Yeah, that silence.
And that silence, he says, was deafening. It created this huge emotional vacuum. And it basically pushed him outwards, you know, desperately looking for noise, connection, somewhere his voice could actually be heard.
Because it wasn't being heard at home.
Not in the way he needed. If the family wouldn't speak, well, the world would have to listen. That seems to be the takeaway.
And then there's his relationship with his father, Bob Hewson, a postal worker, but with this amazing tenor voice, apparently.
Yeah, but their relationship added another layer. It was adversarial, lots of tension, but also this deep unspoken love underneath it all.
Bob was pretty skeptical of his son's music, wasn't he? Preferred the old crooners.
Oh, yeah. Bing Crosby over punk rock.
Right.
Any day. And that friction, that pushback from his dad, became this powerful, lifelong motivator for Bono. Something to push against.
Right, to prove himself.
Exactly. And this whole environment, the silence at home, the friction with his dad, it also pushed him towards finding community elsewhere, like the charismatic Christian group Shalom.
Which brought its own conflicts, didn't it? Faith versus rock and roll.
Immediately. Could you be a devoted spiritual seeker and a, you know, hedonistic rock star? That whole struggle became the absolute heart of early U2.
And speaking of finding community, that really happened at Mount Temple Comprehensive School. It was quite unusual for Dublin then, right? Non-denominational.
Yeah, quite rare. And that's where the magic happened, where the family, the surrogate family began.
1976.
Yeah.
Larry Mullen Jr. puts up a note.
Yep, looking for musicians.
Hmm.
And Paul, Dave Evans, The Edge, and Adam Clayton, they all answered the call. They weren't just forming a band. They were like forging this collective identity, a new tribe almost, to fill those voids from home.
And just as crucial, meeting Ali Stewart there too.
Absolutely. His lifelong partner. She became the calm in his storm, you know, a moral anchor, as he puts it, grounding him.
So the band takes off. They have early success, which leads us to that massive pivotal moment, Live Aid 1985. We all remember the performance, but the book gives you the inside story, the instinct behind that moment.
Oh, it was pure gut instinct, nothing planned. During the song Bad, he just leaps off this enormous stage, down into the crowd, grabs a fan, starts dancing.
And the world saw this incredible connection.
Yeah, for the audience, it was like, wow, this transcendent moment of communion. But for the band, panic, absolute panic.
They thought he'd wrecked the set.
Totally. They thought he'd sabotage their big break by cutting the song short, spending too much time in the crowd. But that single impulsive act, it defined them. The public saw this raw need for connection, for human dignity. It set the course.
Okay, so fast forward a bit. The Joshua Tree is massive, huge success. But then their image, this kind of earnest image, starts to work against them.
Right. Rattle and Hum in 1988, it was a film and an album, and it got critically hammered. People called it pompous, self-important.
Ouch.
Yeah, it forced this massive crisis within the band, a real moment of reckoning. They realized they'd kind of hit the ceiling with earnestness. The only way forward was to tear it all down and rebuild.
Which led them to Berlin.
Exactly, to record Achtung Baby. And those sessions were tense, the city was divided, the band was divided, but they embraced it. Irony, industrial sounds, satire.
And the alter egos were born?
Yeah, Bono becomes the Fly, wearing the big sunglasses, the leather, and later Mephisto, this sort of glam rock devil character. It was a masterclass in resilience, really. They were satirizing their own fame to basically save themselves from it.
And that artistic shift, that willingness to tear down and rebuild, it sort of paved the way for his next act, didn't it? The global activist, the policy wonk, as he calls himself.
Absolutely. The 21st century saw him really lean into leveraging that fame.
Yeah.
Lobbying presidents, prime ministers, even the Pope.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just showing up. He built things.
The organization.
Right. Data debt, AIDS, trade, Africa. That was all about using hard data, real policy proposals to tackle poverty and disease. Very pragmatic.
Then the One campaign.
One focused more on public awareness, political advocacy, fighting extreme poverty, preventable disease, mobilizing people.
Yeah, product, Red.
Partnering with big corporations.
Yeah.
Getting them to contribute a portion of profits from Red products to fight AIDS. Controversial for some, but it raised hundreds of millions. He became this, like, incredibly effective political operator. Could walk into any room, anywhere.
Which brings us neatly to his core philosophy. You mentioned this idea of consequential art. Can you unpack that a bit more?
Yeah, it's really central to understanding him. It's this blend, this fusion of punk rock rebellion, you know, challenging the system, dissent with his quite unconventional Christian faith, which is all about grace, redemption, service.
So consequential art is...
It's the belief that art shouldn't just, you know, reflect the world or entertain.
Yeah.
It has to do something, have to actively work to change the world. His songs, his platform, they're tools for action, pleas, demands, calls to arms.
And he pulls this off by just embracing the paradoxes, like fully leaning into them.
Totally. He doesn't try to resolve them. He's the multimillionaire campaigning for the poor, the self-confessed egomaniac arguing for humility, the sinner preaching grace.
Doesn't he get called out for hypocrisy?
Yeah, constantly. But his argument, especially through characters like Mephisto, seems to be that honesty lies in owning the hypocrisy, acknowledging the contradictions.
So Mephisto is like self-aware satire.
Exactly. He uses that persona to explore the seductive nature of power, fame, ego. It's like saying, yeah, I struggle with this stuff too, but maybe we can harness even these flawed impulses for something good. It disarms the criticism, partly.
So if the art has to be consequential, what's the fundamental engine driving it all? Does it still come back to that early loss?
I think so. He talks about the God-shaped hole left by his mother's death. That seems to be the primary driver, this relentless, lifelong search for connection, for meaning, for something to fill that silence.
The noise of the crowd, the global campaigns.
It feels like it's all connected back to that primal wound, and then that personal pain kind of expanded outwards. When he saw suffering firsthand Ethiopia in the 80s, Sarajevo during the war, it ignited this rage against injustice.
Ah, so the personal fueled the political.
Yeah. He realized his fame wasn't just for music. It came with a kind of moral responsibility, a platform he felt obligated to use.
Okay, let's pivot a bit. Let's talk about three specific turning points, moments that really shifted things for him and for the band, starting with the one that literally saved U2. Writing the song One in Berlin.
Right. 1990, the Achtung Baby sessions. The band was, by all accounts, on the absolute brink of collapse, fighting constantly, totally divided over the new musical direction. Just miserable.
Sounds great.
It was. But then the Edge starts playing these two different chord progressions, fiddling around, and suddenly they mesh. They harmonize in this unexpected way. And Bono, sensing the shift, just starts improvising lyrics over it.
We're one, but we're not the same.
That line, it just came out. And it wasn't just a lyric. It was like the key that unlocked everything. It became their new mission statement almost.
How was it so transformative?
It saved the band, point blank. It gave them a way to acknowledge their deep differences, their conflicts, but still commit to the whole, to the unit. It proved that sometimes the breakthrough comes right out of the breakdown. The desperation itself became creative fuel.
Okay, turning point number two. We touched on it earlier, but let's revisit that Live Aid dance in 85. Why was that leap so pivotal beyond just the immediate impact?
It wasn't just good PR, though it was great PR. It fundamentally crystallized his understanding of his own persona and the sheer power of the YouTube platform. It planted the seed for his activism in a really concrete way.
How so?
It showed him that a single symbolic act, this gesture demanding human connection performed on that global stage, could resonate incredibly powerfully. It gave the music and his role a kind of higher purpose beyond just entertainment. It was about connection, dignity.
Got it. And the third turning point is more recent and maybe more personal, the health scares.
Yeah, these forced confrontations with mortality. The really bad bicycle accident in New York in 2014 shattered his arm, needed complex surgery. Recovery was tough.
Right, I remember that.
And then later, a serious heart condition that required emergency surgery. These weren't just little bumps in the road. They were major reckonings.
How do you frame them?
He writes about them not as defeats, but almost as messages. Signposts, he calls them. They forced him, this guy who's always been about control and willpower, to confront his physical limits, his vulnerability, to surrender control.
And that deepened his perspective.
Absolutely. He talks about increased gratitude, a clarification of what really matters. It reinforced that theme of surrender, not as weakness, but as a necessary acceptance.
Okay, so pulling back a bit, what are some of the human lessons we can take from this really packed life?
Well, one big one is his approach to failure. Look at Rattle and Hum. Critical disaster. Did they retreat? No. They doubled down, tore everything apart, and came back with Octung Baby, arguably their most creative leap.
So the lesson is?
Reinvention is survival. Especially when you've had success.
Yeah.
You have to be willing to question, even dismantle, the very things that got you there if they're no longer working. Don't cling to the past formula.
What about the personality, the ego, the messianic complex charge that's followed him forever? How does the book handle that? Does McPhista really excuse it?
Huh. Does it excuse it? Probably not entirely, but it addresses it head on. He admits the ego is a runaway train. Mm-hmm. He doesn't hide it. He processes that struggle openly through the music, through the personas.
So the lesson there is vulnerability.
I think so. Vulnerability is a kind of strength. By owning the struggle with power, with self-importance, he makes it relatable. Instead of pretending to be perfect, he shows the cracks. And maybe there's more honesty in that. Mm-hmm.
He also really champions long-term commitment, doesn't he? Not just the band staying together for decades, but his marriage to Ollie.
Yeah, there's that fantastic quote. He says their marriage isn't some beautiful floating hot air balloon. It's more like a ship, a cargo vessel.
A workhorse.
It's a workhorse. Mm. It's not pretty, some of it, but it's real. And that's profound, I think. It highlights that real resilience comes from sticking with the difficult, unglamorous long-term work. Whether it's a marriage, a band, or decades of activism, that's the bedrock.
Okay, that feels like a good place to land. Let's distill this down to our three final takeaways. First, the emotional insight. What hits hardest on that level?
For me, it's how personal trauma can be channeled into public purpose. That deep, silent wound from his mother's death, it wasn't just a source of pain, it became the engine, the fuel for this lifelong global quest for connection, for justice, for the roar of the crowd filling the silence.
Right. Okay, intellectually, what's the key idea or strategy we learn from his work, especially the activism?
It's got to be the imperative to marry idealism with uncompromising pragmatism. If you actually want to achieve huge, real-world change, like getting debt relief for poor nations, you can't stay pure. You have to be willing to work with everyone, even people you fundamentally disagree with, like conservative senators.
Like Jesse Helms.
Exactly. You need data, strategy, negotiation. You have to sacrifice ideological purity for tangible results. Idealism needs boots on the ground.
And finally, the universal insight, the big life lesson that applies to anyone.
It has to be the title, really. True strength is found in surrender. And that sounds paradoxical, but he embodies it. Surrendering the ego to the band's collective spirit, surrendering control to the commitment of love, surrendering the fight against physical limits or mortality to a kind of acceptance. It's presented as the ultimate act of courage, not weakness.
Embracing the contradictions, owning the flaws, and finding strength in letting go.
Exactly. His journey really reminds us that our own contradictions don't have to paralyze us. That tension, maybe that's where the energy comes from, between the ego and the service, the sacred and the profane. That's where the vital work gets done.
So a final thought for you, the listener, now that you know the story behind the song One, how it was this desperate, fragile prayer born out of conflict, the thing that saved the band from imploding, listen to it again. Does knowing that context change how you hear its message about unity in our own fractured world? Something to think about.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.